ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Fuel prices can jump overnight, energy policy can shift fast, and the flow-on effects reach everything from households to the wider economy. I'm Carrington Clark, and on ABC Business Daily's Fuelcast, we bring you a quick update on what's happening in fuel, energy, and why it matters. Every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, the ABC Business Daily team will bring you the latest in under 10 minutes. Find Fuelcast in the ABC Business Daily feed on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
The opposition leader has unveiled the coalition's long-awaited immigration policy and called for Australia to discriminate based on values. Angus Taylor says Australians are fed up with politically correct preaching on immigration and suggested some migrants represent a net drain. The hardline proposal includes a kind of Donald Trump-style social media screening for visa holders, and it comes as One Nation continues to surge in the polls, but early cracks are already appearing. Meanwhile, the government is set to inject billions of dollars into drones, but it's not yet clear what defence projects will be reprioritised to accommodate the renewed focus on drone and counter-drone measures. Welcome to Politics Now. Hi, I'm Patricia Karvelas.
And I'm Tom Crowley.
And Tom, at the end of last year, we did a special episode together on immigration. The opposition was at that point set to unveil their highly anticipated immigration policy. It all was being designed, of course, under a different leader, that is Susan Lee, who had been very much a moderate and had tried to reposition the coalition on some of these immigration matters, was clearly being outplayed and pushed by her right-wing backbench and frontbench, and started hardening that position. Then Bondi happened. Of course, I think they made the right decision not making any big releases during that time. It was clearly a time of mourning and crisis. Then the leadership spill happened. There's a lot borrowed from the Susan Lee policy plan, which was leaked earlier this year. But it's now landed. Really some very tough rhetoric, and I'm going to say rhetoric because I think it's a little more flimsy, in my view, on the actual tangible policy front. There's a lot of rhetoric in some of this. They've said some migrants represent a net drain to Australian values. So really, you know, hardline language around bad migrants, good migrants, that sort of binary. It says a bigger Australia has not meant a better Australia. And it is kind of more hardline, I think, than Susan Lee was going to deliver, or is it? I don't know. What's your assessment?
I mean, I think it is. I mean, like, rhetorically, it is right. Like, you mentioned this chat that we had in December, which, you know, yes, there's changes that have happened since then. It wasn't that long ago. And something I remember us talking about back then was that a conversation was beginning in the coalition, and Jacinta Namba-Jimpa-Price was sort of at the forefront of it in what she'd said to you about Indian migrants and getting towards sort of discrimination in the migration system. And in that exchange, you'd said, hold on a minute, it's a long-standing principle of Australia's immigration system that there's no discrimination. And she was forced to walk back and, in fact, ultimately resign from Susan Lee's front bench for even kind of hinting at the idea of a discriminatory migration policy. And Susan Lee's way of talking about the issue was, No, this is an infrastructure piece. That's the phrase she used to use, which was kind of building on the Peter Dutton, who had his own way of expressing things, but it was always about putting pressure on the housing market, and that's the problem here. And it was economic fundamentally.
Yeah, it was like supply and demand, right? If you've got too many people, not enough places to get on a tram, train, or houses, that was the issue, not about the people themselves.
Exactly. And that was starting to shift a little bit by the end of Susan Lee's tenure, and that leaked document maybe suggested that she was moving more in the values direction. But from the get-go, Angus Taylor was Mr. Values. It was our way of life from day one. So in that sense, this is not a surprise. But when you see it laid out in a speech like this, and yes, I agree with you. I think that a lot of the individual dot points and policies we can and will, you know, kind of ask questions about the level of kind of specificity that's there. But the vibes of this speech, there were so many things said in Angus Taylor's address today that I can't recall a Liberal leader ever saying. So many red lines that the party had set itself for how it talks about migration and migrants that have now been crossed. Phrases that deliberately evoke Nigel Farage and Donald Trump, like the phrase take back control, talking about floodgates, talking about migrants coming here with transactional intent and subversive intent, talking about the balkanization of society in the UK and Europe, and the Australians are watching it and they don't want it to happen here. Now, you don't need to have an advanced degree in political science to understand why, and the wager that's been made, and to look at the opinion polls and see why the coalition feels they need to make that dramatic rhetorical shift, because they feel a significant portion of their voter base needs to hear that and doesn't even necessarily care about policy detail. They want that kind of vibe. But I think, yes, on an occasion when you have this set piece delivered at an institute named after Robert Menzies, it is worth remarking on, wow, What a dramatic and rapid change this is rhetorically, that I suppose speaks to the depths of despair about the position the coalition finds itself in electorally, but like pulled in two different directions between urban moderates and diaspora communities and this new One Nation question. Gee, they've decided which way it is number one priority for them to go at the moment, haven't they, PK?
Yeah, they've clearly made a very deliberate decision to go hard here. But I still believe it's high on rhetoric and less on the actual policy. And I'll give you some examples. Okay, they want to bring back temporary protection visas. Oh, God, you know, hello. Pull that policy out every time. Seriously, like, so did Peter Dutton. So it's just stock standard thing to pull out. Then there is, okay, the social media vetting of visa holders. It'll be interesting whether...
Which happens already, apparently. To an extent, ASIO already has some power to do this when they feel it's necessary.
Yeah, so what I want to know is exactly what that looks like. So does that mean... What sort of stuff are we talking about here? Obviously, proper extremism where someone is dangerous. We already, as you say, have that. So then it becomes about political expression perhaps, right? So does a person who says from the river to the sea on a social media post that wants to come to Australia, is that person vetted out? Now, I'm not defending from the river to the sea. I understand why Jewish Australians don't like it. Not all, but many. But is that, does that a criteria for not being within our values? You know, we're now getting into territory of some serious policing of political ideas as well. And so they're the obvious questions. Now, perhaps there are reasonable answers that could be provided to the questions I just framed. But you know what I'm saying.
Yeah, yeah. And that it goes back to the question of, I mean, what's the level of specificity that's actually gone into this policy? Because, you know, when we've seen the social media screening stuff be used more by the Trump administration, as you mentioned, it often is that kind of thing. Mm. It's, you know, we're hearing of Australian students going over to the United States and getting questions about, you know, rallies they've attended or whatever. You know, I mean, that's on the anecdotal level, but that's the suggestion of the kind of the vibes of what it's looking like in the United States. Now, it's not necessarily clear that that is the kind of thing that's proposed here, but what is? Because the bit of specificity that's in this policy is the reference to the Australian Values Statement, which is something that entrants to the country are currently asked to say that they agree to. Angus Taylor's, you know, position, fair enough, is that it's a ticker box exercise, right? That it's not necessarily binding in any particular way and they want to make it binding. Well, okay, but what does that mean in practice? And this was a question that Angus Taylor was getting asked this morning. Is it the minister, the Immigration or Home Affairs Minister, who's making a call about when you violate what is a pretty broad level statement? It says things like respect democracy and the rule of law, you know, equal opportunity for women or on the basis of sexuality, age, disability, all those sorts of things. Is it just sort of a broad assessment that the minister's making or that the department's making at scale? There's been some suggestion that particular behaviours will be set out that contravene the values statement, that'll be a basis for these decisions to be made. But then you get into the territory of, well, we already have a character test with reasonably broad discretion for a minister to cancel people's visas on character grounds. So what's the new thresholds and the new types of behaviour that we want to capture here? You can ask these questions, but then you can also zoom back out and go, well, is the point actually these details, or is the point the signal that you're sending again to voters that we're cracking down on this kind of stuff? And then you get into the tricky terrain of, well, if you're just sending the signal, well, Pauline Hanson's going to send a louder signal, and she's going to be quite happy to kind of go well beyond the scope of what might be legally permissible for a Home Affairs Minister to do and simply say, well, you know, we'll keep them all out. You're playing a game that is kind of difficult to win if you're sticking within the bounds of the policy environment that the Coalition and Labor operate in.
Yeah. Look, this is very much a signal to right-wing voters that they should come back to the Coalition, that they will be hardline on immigration, and that they can essentially stop dancing with One Nation, right? That's what this is about. And they think that there is some mainstream pickup here because it's not just, of course, you know, this idea, which is a massive misnomer, that it's just Anglo-Australians that feel this way, I think is a real misunderstanding of Australia. Yeah, lots of immigrant communities often want to shut the door once they've made it in. We know this. Just some of the buzzwords that we've heard for a long time, mass migration has been one that we've heard for a long time. Angus Taylor really is leaning into that. In his speech, he's criticising, you know, big Labor, suggesting they have allowed the immigration floodgates. So trying to pour pressure on Labor on immigration. And I think it's a kind of significant departure from, as you said at the start, from this idea of discrimination versus non-discrimination. Now, if he was here, Angus Taylor would still argue, and I think, you know, you can see that they haven't named any countries here, or so they have. Let's talk about what they haven't done. They haven't said, ooh, if, you know, if you're Islamic, you can't come here or something. They haven't said that.
Discrimination on the basis of values is the way it's framed.
That's right. So they've kept it. There's a sort of sense of an attempt at some cultural and religious neutrality in that sense, wouldn't you say? They haven't gone hardline there. So it's about signals rather than, you know, a Muslim ban, let's be frank, that some people of the very hard right would prefer. Angus Taylor is not doing that. And I think that matters because, of course, that is kind of really blunt. But it does appear to me that, you know, we are getting some of the significant messages of ideas like that are still kind of jammed into this policy in different ways through signals and coding, yeah? Like even one of the things, so he's taking questions right now, we're recording this on a Tuesday morning, Angus Taylor saying things like, you know, the fact that it's become controversial to stand only in front of Australian flags is just extraordinary. And he says, we've got to get back to celebrating our country. This is all the sort of flag-bearing stuff. Now, the Australian flag is our official flag. He's right. You should be able to stand in front of it. So does the Prime Minister. But all of a sudden, we need to also be, according to the Coalition, be hardline against standing in front of the Aboriginal flag, it seems. Now, that is an official flag of our country, right? Like it is, this is these First Nations people of our country and the official flag that has come to represent them historically now.
It's not a flag Susan that has anything Lee to did. Do with migration in particular, right?
It doesn't. That's the other thing, right? These people are not immigrants. But Susan Lee did stand in front of the Aboriginal flag. She stood in front of both. Yeah.
Yep.
Like she was like, that's fine. This is now a hark back to that sort of Australia Day, Australian signals. It's bigger than just immigration. It's about nationalism, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. But I think the thing that's easy for Pauline Hanson to do, and why she's always been able to do it, is to kind of speak about this in a way that you're speaking to a portion of the audience who might have views that migration need to be lower, who are happy for that to be expressed in a really, you know, kind of blunt and sometimes hostile way. I think you're totally right to point to the fact that a lot of, you know, first, second generation migrants in Australia have mixed views about levels of new migration and might agree on a policy point, maybe even with some of the Australian value stuff. You know, there are a lot of migrant families in Australia who feel proud of, you know, the steps that they have taken to be part of the Australian community and might agree with some assessment that new migrants should face particular expectations in that regard. But I think you got to be really careful in the way that you're talking to people in that category, that you don't frame the migration conversation as about there are particular kinds of people who are Australian, and there are particular kinds of people who are not. And even if you're not directly saying it, the words that you choose, the framing that you choose, we just know that it's really easy to really, really upset multicultural communities and to feel that you are talking about them. And that's the distinction, is kind of where do you draw the rhetorical line in a way that Angus Taylor is saying to migrant communities, you may well agree with us and you're welcome to be part of what I'm saying, versus I'm giving you an impression that this is about you. Because how many times now have we had Liberal front benches derail election campaigns in certain electorates based on one comment about a particular multicultural community? Jane Hume with Chinese spies, Peter Dutton going right back, comments about China, Lebanese community, not during an election cycle, but when Jacinta Namba-Jipa-Price mentioned Indian Australians, how quickly did Alex Hawke and Julian Leeser and people like and Jason Wood, who have significant Indian Australian constituencies, realise the damage, even if some people in that community might want less migration, about comments that make them feel like you're coming after them? That's such a hard, maybe even impossible line to draw. And it's the risk, the harder you go on the rhetoric, that even people who might otherwise agree with you might feel targeted by the way that you're framing this, and then might not go where you're going, especially if Labor models a more moderate version of a lot of these same policies.
So the big question is this sort of a universally held idea in the coalition? Well, my view is certainly it is a majority view in the coalition to back in this, but there are key moderates that are concerned. One person who's been quite outspoken has been South Australian Senator Andrew McLaughlin, who has warned the party against going more hardline on this populist rhetoric on immigration. Now, South Australia is a different place. He says, you know, immigrant communities need to be held and cared for and spoken to by the coalition.
Paul Scar in Queensland.
Yeah. So if you just do the maths on the points they're making beyond, you know, where their heart is, and they're kind of on the numbers, that they are right that if you want to grow your base, grow your party, grow your vote, good place to start is in the many immigrant communities, given we have so much immigration already. Now, of course, that sounds like it contradicts my last point about how lots of immigrants do want kind of strong immigration controls. But then it goes to your point about how far you go about talking about it is the danger. And the big question here is, have they gone too far? Now, I'm not sure. Jury's out. We'll see how the public responds as this trickles down. It takes a while for people to even pick up that a new policy has been announced, or that it, you know, the meaning of it. But, you know, there's lots of elements here. They're restricting first home buyers to only Australian citizens if you want to get any of those subsidies. So lots of coding again around policy that only real Aussies get it, you know? So
And that, you know, like that outer urban question is such an important one. Melissa McIntosh was on Radio National Breakfast this morning, you know, trumpeting the fact that she'd run a survey in her outer suburban Western Sydney seat of Lindsay, and 90% of people wanted restrictions on immigration. But Lindsay happens to be the least culturally diverse electorate in Western Sydney and one of the least diverse urban electorates in the country. There's not enough to win on the basis of seats like Lindsay. And that's what I just think the hard question for the coalition is, yes, okay, I think it's very clear that there is a growing number of a growing view in the Australian community that migration numbers ought to be lower than they have been in the last few years, right? What are you offering that is distinct from both One Nation and Labor, who are not complacent about this issue and they are shifting their own view about migration in a more moderate way? Where is the kind of plurality of votes for the coalition on this issue when you have, you know, reasonably savvy operations to your left and your right who are kind of talking about, you know, kind of like they're sandwiching you on this issue?
Yeah, you can never out One Nation on immigration is really what you're saying,
yeah,
right? You can never,
but out Labor, the centre then on this issue as well, because so many Australians who might say, yeah, I would like the numbers to come down, and I'm now hearing that from Anthony Albanese, but without the rhetoric that I don't like.
And that's the big challenge, I think, still for Labor, though, whether the message that they are already bringing immigration down and are aware of that is being heard in the community. Again, jury's out on that. I'm not sure.
But the economic argument as well, right? Because Peter Malinauskas made this, you know, kind of in a cut-through way in the South Australian election. I think the other thing that Labor will continue to do on this issue is remind people the jobs that need to be filled by young people, and we don't have enough of them, and the role that the migration system plays in the Australian economy.
want to pivot to another story. It's quite big today, be big throughout this week, actually. It's kind of defence week in many ways for the government, I think. Richard Marles addressing the press club, I think it's Thursday. He's the defence minister, deputy prime minister. So today, the government announcing it's set to substantially increase drone technology and counter-drone measures in the next decade. Now, anyone who kind of vaguely even follows modern warfare knows that's where the action's at. That's why sort of there's been a recalibration, reconfiguration of how our military operates, where we put investments. You've just seen the Ukraine-Russia war. There's been such dramatic changes to the way modern warfare looks. Look what's happening in Iran at the moment. Like, it's all changing, and so we're trying to catch up. So it's $12 billion that'll be spent on drones in the next decade. That's an increase of at least, well, I think it's $2 billion on previous plans. Goes again to the government's down payment, if you like, of saying, yep, we will increase defence funding. Now, that will still be criticised that it's never enough, but they are demonstrating that they are doing more. But Labor takes lessons from the war in Ukraine and the US-Iran war, and that's the broader frame it will kind of release all of this in, right, Tom?
It is. And you're going to be annoyed at me here because I'm going to sort of turn this defence question into a budget question.
I can answer that one.
The, you know, I think you're absolutely right about the way that they'll frame it. The key question for me is how much of this will be new money, because in this announcement that was there today, a lot of it seems to be reprioritizing, taking from one part of defence and putting into another. And the question of, like, I think there's an argument Labor will want to be able to say, in this changed global context, we're increasing our investment in defence, but they're also going to want to say that they've improved the budget bottom line, and they're having tough conversations across every portfolio at the Expenditure Review Committee about exactly which of these policy areas they can spend new money on. So how much of this will be offset and how much of it will be genuinely new? That detail was missing in today's announcement. That our broader investment strategy might give us some more clues, but that's just the constraint that they're operating in on every front at the moment.
It is, but what you'll see is that there will be an increase in defence funding, while you'll see cuts to other areas overall in this budget. I think there's a reason for that. You know, elephant in the room, Trump administration, pressure on us to increase defence spending. We're not going to do it to the extent that anyone ever asks, but we are increasing it, and that will become also, I think, a political question, especially with the left-wing base, won't it, about whether that's what should be happening, when the government will also be potentially slashing the NDIS. Now, I think there's good reasons to restructure the NDIS. I'm not going to get into the weeds on that, but I'm just talking optics alone, social programs being pared back, defence being increased. This is a centre-left government, allegedly. Do you know what I mean? These are hard things to sell, aren't they?
Well, has the war changed at all the left-right framing of that, I wonder? Because when a year ago we were talking about increased defence spending, the context was Donald Trump's asking all of his allies to boost their defence spending. But this war has prompted the question of, well, do you need to increase your defence spending because Donald Trump might not be there to help you, I suppose, is the alternative way of framing it. And that will embolden the critics of AUKUS within the Labor Party, and it will make that debate more lively. But the broader question of the total level of Australia's defence spending and the question of whether we need to look after our own defence needs, I don't know, maybe everyone recognises a shift in the world. Although that question of priorities between defence and other parts of the budget, yeah, it's a live one within the Labor caucus, PK.
Oh, yeah, it's very much so. Although that Labor caucus, the most disciplined caucus I've seen, and I've been around the block, my friend. Now, the Prime Minister has gone to Malaysia and Brunei for this fuel charm offensive. Jacob and I, of course, spoke about it in yesterday's episode. If you haven't heard, it's still very relevant. It's not aged. Go listen. The UK and France are set to co-host a summit this week with more than 40 nations, including us, Australia, to discuss safeguarding shipping in the Strait of Hormuz. Now, that's as the blockade from Donald Trump goes on, and really interesting rhetoric, I think, from our own government, which will be pressed more and more on, you know, whether we would assist if asked. Now, they keep saying, we haven't been asked. Okay, well, we haven't. Mm. Let's accept that. But would we anyway? Well, Pat Conroy told me yesterday, even if we were asked, we'd say no. Now, that's not usually the response, but it shows a sort of toughening up, doesn't it? A shift of sorts on this war.
Certainly to the US blockade, although I have a feeling that both Conroy and Richard Miles keep dropping hints about this wedge-tail aircraft and whether in some peacekeeping scenario we could make a contribution if that had some useful role to play, I don't know. But it's interesting that these conversations led by the UK and France, it seems that we're sending an official and it's an official-level conversation rather than a politician-level conversation at this point, because it's a bit of a cart before the horse conversation. We're just sitting back and not seeming to view the global community as being able to play any role in getting the US and Iran to end this thing. We're just talking about the day after, I suppose, in that context. And Australia's view just seems to be US and Iran, sort it out, please, and then we'll talk about some sort of cooperative effort in the Strait.
Yeah, I think the Australian government is also very much like, we're going to try and deal with the fuel crisis part of this and keep our nose as much out of this as possible.
Oh,
and
yeah,
that's, the word possible is key here, because we are a very strong US ally. So what's possible is not always what's probable, right? That's it for Politics Now for today. David Spears will join me on the podcast tomorrow. And if you have a question, send it to thepartyroom@abc.net.au. Of course, we're also getting the band together for a Party Room Live 10-year anniversary of that podcast, which is part of this podcast, which is part of the podcast family. Tom, you're part of the family too. Thank you for helping me understand our crazy world.
Thank you, PK. Always a pleasure, and happy 10th anniversary.
It's all in the show notes. See ya.